You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mm-hmm. I've always known.
You tell me when you're drunk.
What is the worst social behaviour you have ever seen a comedian exhibit?
The whole thing was on speakerphone. It was so weird.
What did she answer?
Me? Fuck you!
If you guess it, I will say yes.
It's now time to play the beautiful game.
It just gets wider the further down you get.
Because that man is a goddamn hero. When they go, oh, I just did this gig in Dubai, I smashed it. He'll go, oh, I'm really proud of you.
I'm Chinese.
But I would like you to visualize the comedian who you hate because you fear you're a little bit like them.
To download the full recording of ComCom Pod Redacted live from the Secret Welsh Comedy Festival, as well as a whole host of other exclusive content, become a member of the Inner Circle at comedianscomedian.com/donate.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hi there, welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here, and today I'm talking to Anuvab Pal, who is a comedian from India, and he is the first comic that's been on the show who is part of the burgeoning Indian comedy scene. I can't believe it's taken me nearly 250 episodes to get my head around this, but as you will hear, the scene is extremely new. We're going to talk a little bit about where it all came from. We're going to talk about Anuvab's process and the differences between the Indian and the British comedy circuits, which are fairly profound, but also have a lot in common. And we're also going to find out a lot about this extremely funny and absolutely charming man. So this is Anuvab Pal.
We're at Soho Theatre.
Yeah.
And how far into your run are you here? I'm afraid. Is it you've just started?
Yeah. So, 5 shows. We finished 2. But there were a bunch of warm-ups in Switzerland, country okay. I'd never visited before.
Uh-huh.
And Cambridge University, there was a gig there where I couldn't see much of the audience, but they looked a lot like, you know, people who would have researched Game of Thrones. You know, there were lots of...
okay.
Long beards and glasses and lots of, you know, people laughing at the most obscure India reference because they're so knowledgeable about it.
Okay, older people rather than younger people.
Correct.
So academics rather than students. Gotcha.
Okay. And if I said something wrong about India, like mentioned some town that was just a lie or whatever, that was the kind of audience I said, that's not true. I went there.
Okay.
I researched in that town 20 minutes south of Jaipur for 40 years. I was studying a tortoise. You know, they...
Sure. And that must, I mean, presumably that... Certainly when I gig in foreign countries, I have a certain amount of agency. Not necessarily with the truth, but I have a certain kind of like...
Yeah.
I'm the guy... You know, I feel I find my feet differently. Maybe faster in some ways in other countries because I'm like, well, it's like this because I say so.
Right.
That must have been a slightly unnerving experience.
You know, that is pretty much my whole set, right? A lot of my set is, these bizarre things happened in my culture, what do you think? Now, the great thing about Britain, this is my first tour of Britain, is you can't lie to British people. They've been everywhere. You know, like there's a mini version of that guy, David Attenborough, whose shows we get.
Sure.
Like it feels like there's a mini version of him in every British person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you know, here I am in Canberra, you know, next to a hippopotamus. Like, everyone's been everywhere. So you have to be accurate about what you're lying about.
Okay.
This was America. You could say anything.
Yeah, true.
You could say, just, we don't have a president. You know, the whole country is run by monkeys. You could say anything, and they would give you that license. Here, people have so much knowledge, plus all our intertwined histories. You have to be careful what you're making up. So I tried to lie less and actually find funny things. And the other thing I find that's really interesting is that this is a culture that gives you a very level playing field. You know, in India, I've done shows, the only other cultures I've done shows in are India and the United States, and both have a sort of deification culture. Like, before a comedian comes on, they're like, he's done this, he's done that, he's done this, he's won the Nobel Prize, you know, he climbed Mount Everest without any legs, like, and then he comes, and huge applause based on credentials. Here, it's like level playing field. Are you funny? Are you not funny?
Yes.
We're going to give you this hour. You could be from anywhere in the world. We do not care. We love you if you're good, and we dislike. And I love that sort of sense of fairness about
okay.
you. I don't know if it permeates into your everyday culture, but on stage, there's this sense of like absolute fairness in that half hour. Like, we'll just judge him for that half hour.
And did you find that different in America? Did you find that... What was the response of an audience in America? They were more like, you get the credits, you get this guy's been doing comedy for X amount of years and he's from India and he's really exciting. He's released, you know, you have a DVD on Amazon Prime. You know, do you find that introduction carries you?
Yeah. And all that, and also they forgive a lot of things. You know, some things that are blatantly not funny, or I've made an idiotic observation, which I do often. They'll forgive it, which they wouldn't forgive a local comedian.
Okay.
You know, or they're just extra nice, you know, very earnest. It's like, oh, this is a tourist. He's not a comedian, he's a tourist. And let's show him the best of our country. Let's laugh and clap and support him.
Sure.
So it can create a false sense of joy.
That's very honest of you. Yeah. You know,
it could create this false sense that, oh, I'm very good. But really, they're just like, you come to my house, we'll be nice to you. Like,
anyway. Yes, okay.
Whereas here, it's like, we know a lot about you. We know about your culture. We've been there. Are you funny?
Yes. And London in particular, I think. I mean, I know you won't have much to judge it against, but I think a lot of comics' experience of touring is that you finish your tour in London and you've been doing great stuff in everywhere in the UK apart from London. Then you come here and everyone is that much closer to sitting back and going, yeah, we had lots of options tonight. Do you know what I mean? There's a certain reservation of like, well, you know, you need to prove yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that, you know, like, for example, in India, we have shows Friday and Saturdays. Because the comedy venue we do shows in, they're not dedicated comedy venues. So rest of the time, it's being used for an aluminum conference.
Okay.
Or it's being used for a big industrialist wedding. Or, you know, so there's a sense of like, oh, I've conquered the world by doing a half an hour show on a Saturday. Because you spend the rest of the weekend eating pasta thinking you're a genius.
Sure.
But here, there is a kind of work ethic. You're on for 10 nights. You have to be good for 10 nights. You know, the guy on the fourth night has 7 things to do that night. You're one of them. And he's paid the same amount of money as the first night and the last night. And so that kind of discipline is something I'm learning. You know, just to shut up and just do the work. You know, and that's a lovely Western ethic I like. You know, that, and from what I'm seeing of other comedians, they're on the road 100 nights. I've heard Edinburgh is 30 nights, relentless, sometimes twice. And, you know, I just... Sometimes what happens, like, Indian cricket teams will come to Britain and play a test and it'll be windy and cold. And very soon, like, 3 people are injured, sick. Complaining, ah, it's cold. And I just... And my thing is that just don't be that guy. Maybe the show's good, maybe the show's bad, but just have the discipline to understand what the comedy culture is like. And put in the work, you know. This is sounding very earnest, but I said I'm learning the routines of British comedians and how hard they work.
So get me up to speed on comedy in India. I don't think we've had a gigging India. I mean, is there a circuit?
There is, yeah. It's a pretty big circuit. You know, the circuit's large now, and it's not necessarily in English. There are a group of English comedians, but they're sort of city-specific and a little bit sort of by default elitist because of the language.
Okay.
So they have their own audience. But you have to be very careful with the English language, and because if you come out sounding like this, and it's not my fault, you know, I just ended up with a Victorian education system.
Okay.
But when you go out, like in Britain, I think it's okay to speak like this because everyone speaks like this. Mm-hmm. In India, when you speak like this, you're like, what a privileged, dirty, great person this is. And now he's going to talk about like Indian things, like look down at it, you know. There is that, because you guys have a class system and we have a class system. I don't know who gave it to whom, but we have it. And whereas, you know, you've got comedians like Zakir Khan, who's sort of like your Peter Kay, you know. He talks about average middle class things and nostalgia. And he says, you know, when I walk into an environment that's English speaking, filled with posh people, this is my experience. Don't you feel that way? And some 20,000 people go, yeah, we feel that way.
Okay.
And when I go to buy Levi's jeans, they discriminate against me because I look like a car cleaner or whatever. Don't you feel that way? And then there are comedians like me, and our only approach is to sort of make fun of ourselves and how we may have been stuck with this.
You appear to be, or you naturally are, a higher status than the audience? Or that's the fear, is that you'll come across a higher status than
the latter,
audience?
Yeah, okay. The fear. And oftentimes, you know, if you come across something like this or have an American accent or whatever, there is that sense of like, is he going to talk down to us? So the biggest thing to negate that when I started my comedy career is to say, you know, how to sort of drop yourself in the class barrier and say that, yes, I may sound like this, but, you know.
Yes, I've noted on one of your sets, you walk out and go, God, I tried to make an effort with what I'm wearing, but now I ended up looking like I forget the exact punchline. It's like, look, a professor or something, I'm going to sell you insurance. Yeah, absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So there is the physical aspect and there's the language aspect. In India, I often say, you know, I sound like this, but now I can't speak to anyone because I turned around and everyone expects me to speak Hindi. And I sound like a love child of Stephen Fry and a Bangalore call center worker. And you say something like that, and the people are like, oh, all right, he's okay.
He gets it, yeah.
He gets it. He understands that he's not going to talk down to us. And then, initially, a lot of time was spent just making fun of your class of people.
Mm.
Like, oh, aren't posh people like this, aren't posh people like that. And then slowly, dangerously, I crept towards more mainstream India, you know. I thought it was... And once they give you the license, it's like, it's okay to talk about politics and arranged marriage and there's a fantastic comedian called Varun Grover who's from a small town in India, and he talks about trains in India.
Okay.
And he talks about how how Indian people are thieves and how we distrust each other in that in Indian toilets, because a lot of Indian trains have Western toilets and Indian toilets.
Okay.
Because people are not used to Western toilets.
Okay. Yeah?
So in those, you don't have toilet paper, you have a mug of water to wash your bottom.
Okay.
And he says, we distrust each other so much, they usually tie that mug with a chain. So they're like, this is how much trust there is amongst each other, that they don't even trust that guy to wash his bottom and leave it there. Now, if I make that joke, it's a class thing.
Yes, I understand.
Because there's an English-speaking person. He's like, he would go to the Western toilet. He wouldn't even go to that toilet. Why is he making fun of... making fun of our toilet?
Yes,
it becomes an us and them thing.
Sure.
Whereas Varun, who's a homegrown comedian, has full right to do that. So navigating this has been very interesting. And of course, there are great female comedians like Aditi Mittal or Radhika Vaz who... I mean, there's no shortage of, issues that women are facing in India, given the sexism, racism, you know. So it's all of that stuff that's going on in the West, but magnified much more.
Mm-hmm.
What consent means, all of that. So there's a whole set of comedians doing that. And then there's other people doing class and other people just doing politics. And politics is very dangerous because, in your culture, you have sort of a freedom of speech. Like if you say something about, say, Boris Johnson, they're not going to, like, beat you up or arrest you or whatever. But in India, you have to be very careful. Kunal Kamra, who's a very good political comedian and dear friend, after a gig, I usually message him saying, are you all right?
Right, okay.
Because sometimes he's had to go and stay in other friends' houses and stuff. So there's that. But when you reach a lot of people, because YouTube has been a great mechanism in India to reach a lot of people. Some comedians have 2 million views, 10 million views.
Mm-hmm.
10 million people, a lot of people. And not all of them with a sense of irony.
Yes, yes, it makes you more discoverable, of course, yeah. The internet. And maybe if you don't want to be discovered, that's problematic. Are there any comics in India staying off YouTube for that reason?
Yeah, I was for a long time. I mean, but then Amazon happened, and then it's hard to hide. You know, like, you guys have a culture of live shows, but the comedian doesn't put up his half an hour on YouTube. In India, the comedian became famous by putting up his half an hour on YouTube. And then, you know, he had a following, and then that led to the live shows, which is still the trajectory. Everybody in India who's a comedian wants a million views. And that's what leads to public shows and corporate shows. Mm. But once you do that, and you say something against the government, authority, whatever, a million people have seen it. You haven't performed in a basement in Mumbai to 50 people. You're not a cult hero. You're now... the Ministry of Information and Broadcasting is looking for you.
and just to give me some sort of sense of, like, what are the... like, what's the worst that could happen? You say they beat you up? Is it a case of imprisonment? Has that happened to anyone you know?
They have a thing where a police complaint is filed. And I know many comedians against whom police complaints have been filed. V. Das, who's a big Indian comedian...
yes.
...once did an impression of an Indian president during one of his live shows... and someone brought the police to the show. So at intermission, he was waiting to go on. He's blogged about this. And then police show up. And this is really funny. Sometimes some of these are funnier than, you know, the comedy shows themselves. Because the police were like, you know, we've been called and you were apparently mimicking the president. Before you go on, do the thing you did. And he's like, I gotta go on, man. He's like, no, do the thing so we know that it's not offensive, or we may have to take you away.
Oh God!
So he was like, oh yeah, this is what I did. And he's like, no, they said they're fine. Go on.
Oh my God!
So
okay.
Some of that happened,
and that was presumably fine as far as that police officer was concerned.
Yeah. But
presumably, once that, you know, like, he had to decide, I imagine, in that moment, whether to do an edited version, like a safe version of the bit. To show to the police.
I never thought of that.
And then
yeah.
Go and do the real bit.
Absolutely.
Or he has to decide whether to risk doing the real bit and then risking the ire of that policeman.
That's a very good point. Now that I think about it, maybe V just didn't even do a mimic. Like, whatever he did on stage,
sure.
He just went there and did a very respectful
sure.
imitation.
Oh, I'm the president. Aren't I giving and generous?
Yeah.
That's the bit.
Yeah, sure. I love all Indian people. He's like, that's fine. That's not an arrestable offense. Go on stage. Maybe, yeah, maybe we do something. But exactly. So comedians have to do things around the system.
Okay.
But, you know, like, for example, it's almost comic when I mentioned to my British comedian friends that for saying something on Mock the Week or any of those shows, imagine if you lived in a culture where you could be arrested.
Yeah.
You know, if, like, Ian Hislop said something on one of those shows and, someone filed a police complaint, and whether he was arrested or not, he still have to show up in court.
Yes.
And defend what he said on Mock the
Week.
Like, that to people here is ludicrous and funny. And
yes, yeah. It is. I suppose the nearest we get to that is sort of, it's not politically oriented. I think Frankie Boyle was taken to court. Or Frankie Boyle took the son to court for accusing him of being a racist, and he took them to court and he kind of defended himself and won the case because they quoted a joke of his out of context and said, you're a racist. And I believe this is the blind leading the blind. I've no idea of the details, but this is, that's a very different case, I guess.
Meaning an audience member said, you are racist. And he said, I'm not. And I'm
no, I think the Sun, and I'm saying it might have been the Daily Mail or any other scurrilous tabloid newspaper. I believe they accused him of racism.
Yeah.
And so he took them to court to sort of officially say, look, I'm not going to let people call me racist because he's not racist. He's actually, Frankie Boyle is someone who's known for his outrageous jokes, outrageous sense of humour, a very brutal sense of humour. But I think largely, politically speaking, his heart's in the right place.
And that's what's... I think this is an art form where you should have that licence, right? And what's interesting is that fight was about content, right? Like, you said something that is racist, not racist. We've got a law that says you can't hurt the sentiments of a particular community. And if you've got a billion people with varying sense of irony and knowledge,
sure,
everything hurts your sentiments. You know?
Yes,
like,
of course.
I was talking to my neighbors and I said, some children were playing cricket outside in our building compound, and one of them hit a ball and it broke one of the car windows. And I said, children are just idiotic. And I just said that to my neighbor. And he said, I don't like jokes about children. There's a limit. So, like, yeah, imagine okay. if that guy, my neighbor, had gone to a show and someone was going on and on about children. That could be hurting his sentiment. So, legally, you know, there's a lot of thing. And all of this makes it just very distasteful and humorless, you know? It just...
And do you, am I right in thinking that the stand-up comedy scene in India is quite new?
Very, very.
Like, this sounds awful. I don't know if this is true. I understand the stand-up scene in India to have kind of been kick-started by the Comedy Store opening a comedy store in Mumbai.
100%.
Is that right?
100%.
You can see from the point of view of a white Londoner saying, well, apparently we invented comedy.
British comedy.
Doesn't
yeah.
sound great,
yeah.
does it?
Yeah. No, but that's just a fact. I mean, you just can't deny it, you know? It's like saying, well, how are you speaking English? Same way.
Yeah, sure.
Somebody
okay.
showed up. So that's just a fact. Don Watts said the Comedy Store. There were English comedians in India, but it wasn't formalized. There wasn't a club. And every star of that by generation, I mean just like 8 years ago.
Yes.
Every person that's gone on to do whatever, you know, some people have shown up in the United Kingdom, some people have gone around the world, some people have almost gone to prison. All of this came out of the comedy club that he started. And all these people sort of blew up from there.
And as I understand it, as I have colloquially heard the story, quite quickly, the Indian comics said, we can do this ourselves. Like, we don't actually need there to be a British presence running this club. Is that right?
Well, I think the comedians were all very fond of the Comedy Store. I think there was a business issue between the Indian owners and the British owners. But
fine.
The comedians...
I don't know about that. We'll leave that.
The comedians love what Don did and are personally very fond of the Comedy
right.
Store and very thankful for everything that... Because this never existed. Do 30 minutes, there'll be a host. You know, initially, nobody knew what this meant. It was just a person going up and just saying stuff about the country, about themselves. They knew theatre, they knew film. But this wasn't... I remember people tried to emulate what Don did in restaurants and so on. And I remember very early, 2008-09, going up just about when the Comedy Store started, because they thought, you know, thousands of people were going to this and it was a big business success. So they saw that and said, what is this? It's just red lights, microphone, bunch of people, we'll do this. Right? So I remember there was a seafood restaurant that said, we'll pay you, comedians, come down and do it. Except they had to announce to their diners that there was a comedy show.
Teething problems.
So Saurabh and I, like, there's a colleague of mine, very, now very famous, and we did this gig and he's quite profane. He comes out and talks about, I don't know if it's appropriate to say
that's
here,
fine.
But
that's
yeah,
fine.
He says, he talks about, like, I have very large balls or something. He says something about testicles and so on. And there was a Gujarati family eating right in the front row. And the father, I heard, saw the father telling the daughter, why is he sharing that about his testicles? And they just didn't have any context. People were coming out and saying, you know, doing like... And that time the material also was like, a lot of it for all of us was like, it's either like a version of something we'd seen on TV. No one had found their voice.
Yes, okay.
So people were just like swearing a lot because they thought that was the thing to do.
Yes.
Or people were imitating a favorite comic because they thought there was a thing to do. The venues were all over the place. I remember once in 2011 being invited by a famous tire company. I think it was a British, maybe Bridgestone or one of those. And the CEO loved stand-up. And this was in a town called Pune, which is a little outside Mumbai. And they were having their annual sales awards. So it was 2,000 tire salesmen. And he thought it would be great if the comedian didn't just run out on stage and do the set, but if he sat inside a tire. And there was a giant display tire on stage, which was mid-air. And he thought it would be great if the comedian sat inside that tire when the show started. Mind you, no one was told there's a comedian. So what 2,000 tire salesmen saw was a middle-aged Indian man in a suit sitting in a tire some 40 feet above the stage. And then from backstage, they said, ladies and gentlemen, you're comedian for the night. And they started bringing me down, right? This is India, the hydraulics malfunction. So now I'm dangling some 20 feet above. They can't do the gig. So they decide, cut the comedy. Let's move on to the rest of the program. I'm up there for an hour while the CEO gives his sales report. There are two Uzbek ladies that do some fire dancing. Uh-huh. I'm up there the entire time. This is, I mean, I've had...
Did you have your phone with you? Could you take pictures and broadcast?
I mean, just imagine the embarrassment. Just, you know, I just like, I figured any slight movement, and I've never been inside a tire before. I mean, it was already, you know, such a respectable thing to do, to quit your day job. I used to be a journalist and be in a tire in the middle of a field in Pune, 30 feet above everyone. So, like, any sort of wit beyond that was in, like... I was just thinking, you know, like, this is perhaps the most embarrassing moment of my entire life. You know, just... But colleagues have gigged in you know, like, people were... This is like the Wild West, right? People were thinking this is a thing, so we'll do it. I've had colleagues gigging who were told that there's a gig, and they go to a five-star hotel, and the five-star hotel thought it'd be great to do the gig by the poolside. So they set up, like, a platform in the swimming pool with diners... you know, on shore, if you will. But the thing about a platform is it's a floating platform. So the comedian floats away mid-story. So imagine my colleague, like Rajneesh, he was doing this gig and he was telling me about it. He starts telling some story about, he's like, I have a crush on my mother-in-law. Like he says, and then he floats
just disappears.
And the crowd are just like, well, he'll be back to tell us the rest. You know, this was just this maverick.
This is like an incredible microcosm of, like, I mean, it's so fascinating to hear the story of a country as large as India suddenly discovering this art form. And, like, everyone making all their mistakes in one go. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, just learning and pushing it in different directions.
I mean, if you...
So were you there at kind of year zero for that? So what was your very first experience of it? You went along to one of the shows? Or when did it occur to you personally to go, maybe this is a thing I could do?
So Don Ward at the Comedy Store was having auditions. And I was already writing films. I was sent by a magazine to check it out. And Don said, I won't give you an interview unless you do 10 minutes. Someone told me you do comedy writing. I said, yeah, well, yeah. And he said, no, everyone that comes here has to audition. And then I auditioned, and then I didn't think it was going to be anything. Like, I honestly, till today, I remain a pessimist about the Indian comedy scene. I think it's all over tomorrow.
Okay. That sentiment is echoed in all major cities of the world.
Oh, really?
about those cities. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Everyone in Britain is like, it's contracting. Is this going to last? There's too many of us now. Oh, it's going to explode. It's going to implode, you know.
Really? That discussion is similar?
100%.
Even though you've had a culture for 40 years?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I think one of the prevailing narratives is, there's so much comedy online now. People don't need to leave the house. No one's got any money anymore. People don't want that live experience. And we've experienced over the last 10 years, almost as soon as I myself became professional, I was just thinking, yes, I'm doing it, my dream job. And then, what do you mean it's all going to go pop? You know, I think we have the scene in New York to look at and go, in LA, where we go, well, there's loads of comedians, but you can't make money from being a comedian.
Correct.
And, you know, you can't go there and earn any money. You have to be able to headline and be famous and make a huge amount of money. But actually, what we've had it so good here for so long that then after the economic crisis, then people stopped going out. There was suddenly lots of comedy on TV. And clubs that would previously have done a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night went down to Friday, Saturday, and now just Saturday in some cases. So it's been contracting at the same time as loads of new comedians have started. None of those things is necessarily bad at all, certainly it enables... You know, I think anyone could look at their exciting thing and think and share that sentiment of like, oh God, it's all over tomorrow.
It's finished. Yeah, we used to. I used to wake up and tell whoever was booking me, I was like, oh, right, I might as well do a good show because this is over. He's bankrupt. He's going to go back to his day job.
Sure.
But the thing, you know, has exploded and keeps growing and growing in different languages with Amazon coming and doing their thing. And but at the same time, you know, it's very interesting to hear that because the model they're trying to copy is finally 10 years down, they're trying to put some systems in place.
Mm-hmm.
So clubs are being formed. So I guess where Britain was in the 60s, first, like, you know, you go there, you do half an hour, you stick to your time, you get paid 5,000 rupees. Like, it was earlier, just all over the place.
Sure.
Right? You got paid in cash, you didn't get paid, or you got paid too much. Like, there was someone mentioned that there was a couple that was celebrating the anniversary. They'd seen a comedy show. and they wanted to purchase a show, but it was just them, a couple in a hotel room. They wanted to, and then they wanted to buy a half an hour set of a comedian to be performed once they finished their dinner in their hotel room on their 20th anniversary. And I was like, is that slavery? Like, is that comedy or slavery? Like, you're buying a person who will show up and do what exactly?
Yes.
And so that's where things work.
Well, the other thing it makes me think is that there is certainly room for some unscrupulous Indian promoters to come over to the UK, watch the worst of our promoters' ideas over here, and then take them back and, you know... Wait, you know, there must be lots of opportunities to really exploit acts. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, look, where I come from, deceit and theft are very respectable things. You know, so I think that what you've described is basically the modus operandi of every Indian promoter. It is not the aberration. It is basically, that is the business model. Like, let's come here. Although, yeah, having said that, the young promoters are changing. You know, they are coming here. They're going to Edinburgh. They're going to... I don't know if you know Shomendra. He's a big Indian promoter out of Bangalore. He runs a club. They're making an effort to learn. Because okay. The first generation of promoters were just that. Were just, you know, oh, I can do this, you know. Oh, what's the aspect that I need to ignore? Pay the artist. Let's take that out. Lights I've got. I won't, you know, I'll overcharge for the bar. Whatever. Like,
sure.
Basically, they break it down to the best way to make money. And that's... I was fortunate enough to have my grooming in that generation of comedians,
mm-hmm.
of comedy promoters. Luckily, this generation has Amazon and other things. But yeah, I got the best of the deceit. Yeah.
So this is Anuvab. What a lovely bloke. Really charming and genuinely has something to say with his comedy. I hope you'll check him out at this year's Edinburgh Festival. So remember, you can find him and all your other ComCom heroes that you want to see up there at edfringe.com. So do check out his show. He's an absolutely charming presence, a very funny guy, and has got some really interesting subject matter worth hearing. So do find out more from Anuvab. And if you are particularly of a mood to hear more from him, we talk about some very interesting topics on the extra content. Now, as you'll remember, if you've been up to date with the podcast, over the last few weeks, I've been talking about the Insiders podcast. That's a special thing for hardcore fans of the show. It's a whole other private podcast available just for insiders. How can I become an insider, you wonder? Well, it's very easy to set up. In fact, if you struggle with setting up, I will personally get in touch with you over email and help you sort it out. And it's also easy to cancel, so don't be put off giving it a try. Get on to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for all you need to know. We've got loads of different projects on that, not to mention extra content from all of the old episodes, all in one convenient place. And all of the extra content going forwards is only going to appear exclusively on that private podcast. You can also do a thing called You Interview Stu, where you pitch to interview me about the subject of your choice. We've had two or three of those already. They've been great fun. And you can also participate in Comedy Critique, where new comedians send their material in, you know, a YouTube or an audio clip of their stuff, and then we as a ComCom Pod insider community all feast on it and offer them feedback and have a group conversation about that. So there's loads and loads of stuff to be enjoyed. It's really a great way to get closer to some of the themes of the podcast and a little bit closer to the kindred spirits within the ComCom Pod community. comedianscomedian.com/insiders, and on that page as well, if you don't fancy joining up or if you've got too many podcasts in your life already, you can just do a one-off donation as normal in support of the show. Also, you can share it, tell your friends about it, and walk up to strangers in the street and borrow it on the back of their upper arm. My tour is going great. That's been pretty fantastic. I've been really blown away. I haven't had much of a base in the north previously, and this weekend I've been in... it's all merging. It's not merging into one, but it's one big long thing. Where have we been? Sheffield was great fun. Thanks to the listeners that came along there. I did last night, as of this recording, I did York, which was just superb. What a lovely club there, the Burning Duck Comedy Club in York, which was full, very gratifyingly. And I find out today that perhaps because of that, and people very kindly telling their friends, I have doubled the audience that I thought I was going to sell to in Newcastle at the Stand. Tomorrow I'm in Leeds, but that will have passed by the time you hear this. It's been so much fun, and there are a few dates still left on the tour. Soho Theatre at the end of June, and before then, Southampton, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Birmingham, Brighton,
Tring and Cardiff, not forgetting those London Soho Theatre dates. And I tell you what, if you're in Bristol or near Bristol or anywhere in the Southwest on the 14th of June, you can come along and see a live DVD recording of the show, like I mean it, at the Old Assembly Theatre. All details, as ever, from comedianscomedian.com/tour. Let's get back to the brilliant Anubhav Pal.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So just to take us back to that first, to your personal voyage into it, you were a journalist in what kind of field?
I was a business journalist for Reuters, the news organization.
Oh my God, okay.
So it helps, you know, in a... Just understand, like, the whole empire set. The fact that, you know, we're given this sort of Victorian value system, but we live in India. That's now very American and social media focused. That's a big learning, right? I mean, being a journalist gave me that perspective. Because I wanted to write jokes that were bigger than, like, oh, my mother-in-law hates me. You know, like, and to get that perspective, I think 10, 15 years in journalism helped. You know, where does India stand vis-a-vis America? And,
yes.
You know, just every time I came here for journalist work, I was very, like, I was quite taken by British politesse, you know, like, we don't have any tact. Like, there isn't any Indian politesse. So, like, if someone, like, if you met an older Indian person and they would be like, Stuart, you're looking very ugly today. Like, they would just say that.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Just
okay.
And here you had a culture where people would be like, I have a slight problem with your presentation. And they mean the presentation is the worst they've ever seen. That you should die, you know, that's what they mean. So it only came from journalism. The fact that I traveled and I could compare cultures, see what's important where.
Okay.
And a lot of that creeps into the set.
Yes, you're a very literate and very articulate. You know what I mean? You're one of those comics who can kind of place just the show you're doing at the moment, which I've seen some clips of, but I'm afraid I haven't seen the whole show. As you say, it's about empire, and you're able to place it in a sort of broader historical and geographical context.
Yeah, you know, and the jokes, you know, one of course looks for jokes, but just having that context, you know, just coming to Britain and saying, look, I have this voice because you guys gave it to me, but now I'm out of place in my country. What do you think? It's really to start that conversation.
Yes.
And then the mechanics of, like, where the jokes are, etc. I sometimes find I enjoy having the conversation more than the pressure of the comedy. Because, like, now I've done it 10 times, and the moment I start thinking about mechanics, the laughs here, A, I stop enjoying it, and B, I think, oh, God, I'm going to repeat myself, I'm going to screw it up, you know? The moment it gets into mechanics, but the moment I step back and I think, hold on, think back to your journalist days. What you're having is just a broad conversation about your culture with a bunch of people who are heavily inebriated and are interested. And
yes,
you're trying to find a common bond of, like, so that they can be like, yes, that's my family as well. You know, like, that's the effort. You know, that's the whole joy of traveling to other cultures for me, you know.
So what you're describing there seems like, is that a thing that you've learned throughout your comedy process? Did you start from a place of wanting to be a comic like the comics you'd seen? And it sounds like what you've discovered is your strongest suit, or maybe your most pleasurable place on stage, is to have some information to impart that isn't simply opinion-based.
That's absolutely right. It was a mix of both. And specific things, like, for example, I saw Eddie Izzard, and I loved the idea that two people can have a conversation. And just the idea that... And before that, I'd seen stand-up shows, you know, where people would talk and say funny things. But here I saw stand-up where a man would just make a whole scene appear on stage.
Yes.
There'd be a pelican in a corner, a governor general, we'd be in Uganda in 1550, and five people would be talking, and he'd be all of them.
Yes.
And I, because I came from a script writing and journalism background, I was like, that's incredible. That's incredible that that was even possible in stand-up. And so that was the mechanic that really interested me. And then the stories were like, surely there's got to be stories in my culture where I can deploy that mechanic. You know, so that's how those two got together, where I can take a British man in 1650 who comes to Calcutta, who's just confused out of his mind, sweating, like, what is he doing here? And then who are the people in the scene, you know? And my difficulty has been, once you lay out the mechanics, it's great fun the first time. But because I come from a writing background, I think, okay, how do I keep it consistent night after night? Like,
yes,
how do
okay.
I, without, if I invent new things every night, it may not be funny.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there are some things that are working that I need to repeat. But how do I not think, oh God, I'm repeating, it's sounding artificial.
Yes.
How do I keep it like I've just discovered this on stage?
Yes. Yes, and how are you solving that problem?
With your help, maybe. Yeah. I'm not a steward. You guys are masters of comedy. I'm learning every day. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting talking to, you know, Ross Noble.
Long hair. I know
yes,
who he is. I've
yes.
seen him on some shows. Yeah.
Yeah, so his comedy is like at the very extreme edge of improvisation. And he's been on this podcast and he was talking about one of the things that really sticks in my memory is that he was talking about how as soon as he has a bit that really works, he makes sure he takes it apart again. Specifically to cope with that. Now he's a, you know, that his stock in trade is 100% improvisation. And he released was it the Space Cowboy tour? He released a tour DVD which had 8 different versions of the same show. Just 8 different DVDs. Like this is all the same show, just have all of it. Because he's just constant, they're all different.
So are you saying he found 5 minutes that people were losing their minds over?
Yes.
And he said he committed harakiri. He said, I'm
yes.
not gonna do this.
Yeah, and he does that constantly with every aspect of his show. So as soon as he has a bit, if he's kind of often getting into the track, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting him here, but if he has a bit about walnuts, then maybe one night the walnut thing will really click, so he'll make sure that he doesn't repeat that again. He'll make sure that he does something different with the walnut idea. So it's constantly churning over. And I mean, I'm not suggesting you do that.
No, I think you may have saved my tour.
Yes.
I think.
Well, there are no rules.
Yeah.
That's the most exciting thing about comedy. And it's very exciting for me as a lifelong comedy fan to see you as kind of archetypical of a culture who are embracing it and learning in the moment and being keen to go, how can we fix this?
Yeah.
Because what an incredible amount of kind of creative energy to go, yeah, this is a problem I'm having. What do I do about
yeah.
it? And I think, there are no rules. That's the most, I think all of us in this country, in America, all of us to some extent are guilty of doing an impression of what we think a comedian,
yeah.
in air quotes, is supposed to do.
Yeah.
And you have to constantly remind yourself, no, whatever I do is the right thing.
Yeah.
Whatever I do is my process, however I approach it.
And that's what I've noticed, that they would reward authenticity over a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
Like people will reward authenticity. Someone came in and said, you know, I found you really likable, but on the first night,
mm-hmm.
but you were itching to do talk about the empire more, but it seemed like you lent on jokes that had worked before.
Yes.
And I said, that's absolutely true. How could you tell that from the show? They said, you could see it in your eyes.
This was another comic that said this.
An older gentleman who's
okay.
a comedy, who's a, I mean, everyone at the performance space at Soho knew
mm-hmm.
him. He was a very established Andrew something, I forget his name.
Okay.
But he had a lovely chat after at the bar and he said, I could tell in your eyes that you were itching to do some stuff, but maybe you'd never done it before, so you were worried how we'd react. And I was like, that's absolutely true. So, you know, when you're inauthentic, they can just like immediately realize.
Yes.
And also the hard part for me is, you guys grow up in a culture of creativity, right? From a very young age, people, your parents encourage you, you know, think, what do you think of this painting? What do you think of, what do you think? You know,
mm-hmm.
what do you
mm-hmm.
as a child think about these things? I grew up in a culture of like, just study this, just memorize
yes,
it.
Mug it.
Mug it up.
Yeah,
mug
yeah,
it
mug
as
it
we
up.
Say.
That's it. Well,
mug
I
it up.
Heard this in, I've seen the Amazon Prime, your DVD.
Yeah.
Yes,
we memorize
exactly.
stuff. We, and so.
That's a very funny bit. You drawing the parallel between that and then your American, more American free thought.
Free thought. And
yeah.
this culture is the same. You take your kids to museums. You're like, what do you think of Mona Lisa? What do you think of this? What do you think of. Now, if I had that, I'd have the confidence to destroy a set. What happens is that Ross Noble grew up in that world. What happens to people like us is you think, oh, I've got a good hour. I'm
yes.
going to cling on to that hour. I'm
yes.
going to make a living out of it. And I have to, like, basically undo my entire Indian education.
Yeah, yes.
Not the knowledge. The knowledge bit is great,
sure.
you know, but undo the mechanics of it. to find some creativity.
Yes, well, I think what you might do is to... What we all have to do, I think, to some extent, is to remember the insanity of your first choice to set foot on stage and try to recreate that boldness every night. Because the difference between you, the journalist, and you, the person who went, right, I'm doing it, I'm going on stage and trying to talk... We're trying to make people laugh for 10 minutes. That leap was an enormous leap. And then as soon as you've made that enormous leap, however many years, 5, 8, 10 years later, very easy to retract back into just a slightly, and I'm not talking about you here, all of us,
but to retract on.
Into a slightly risky version of ourselves, but mostly safe.
Very
safe.
Do you know what I mean? Very safe.
Yeah.
2010, Stuart, I was fearless. I was fearless because I thought this is going nowhere. I thought this is a lovely British gentleman who's asked me to stand on a stage in the middle of Mumbai in a nightclub he started and talk for 5 minutes. What's the worst that'll happen? Right? I have a day job. I'm married. But, you know, 2015, when you're sitting in a tire and it's your only living.
Yes, and you gave up a very good career.
it was going all right. So, journalist, and, you know, there's a laid out track, whatever. Although today... I don't know, journalism is probably as extinct as comedy.
Sure, so. Maybe you got out at just the right time.
So it's hard to tell. But the point is, there was a fearlessness. It felt like a pastime. The moment it's not a pastime, you think, oh, I must cling on to these jokes because people laugh. Laugh means tickets. Tickets mean this. But I learn from a lot of young Indian comedians now who are fearless, who've had... Kunal Kamra is a kid that comes to mind. I call him a kid. He's 30, but he's goes out every night like it's his first night, you know, and they are young, so, you know, they're also smoking some substance that's illegal or the other, and you know, they're not like tensing up and drinking water and thinking, I don't want to mess this up at Soho, and there's a certain kind of disrespect is not the right word, but let's, like, for me, because I grew up in such an anglicized country where Britain was such held in such high esteem. Performing in London is a big thing. You know, I'm performing in London. You know, British people are laughing at this. This new generation don't have any of that.
Yes.
Like, they're like, I'm going to explore. Just like, you know, it's a dark stage and red lights. And I'm in London. I'm in Goa. It doesn't matter.
There's a thing, we've spoken before on the podcast about this. There's a thing that American comics seem to delight in doing, which is to walk on. They'll have a stool and they'll walk on and put some notes and their phone down on the stool. Like, the fact that their phone is on stage, like, projects this air of casualness to the... Like, this is just a gig, guys. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I'm just... My phone's here. Mm. And throughout the show, they'll wander over and just look at their set list on their phone and go, okay, yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like this big...
And how do British audiences react to that? Does it seem like they didn't prepare enough?
I don't know. I think if the gig is going well, it doesn't matter. I mean, that's the thing with comedy, isn't it? If they're laughing, it doesn't matter what you did. Yeah. I remember one of the best bits of advice I've ever given, Alan Cochrane, a good friend of mine. When I started comedy, I remember asking him about what shoes I should wear or saying, I've got a particular gig. I don't even know what shoes to wear. And Alan said, if they're looking at your shoes, you're not funny. You know, because you get a pass for everything. I think this every time I get a haircut. Yeah. Why don't I just get a Mohican? Why don't I shave my head? It doesn't matter. I'm a comedian. I can do whatever I want.
Fair,
but what I want to do is sort of just be the same, you know, be like, play it safe. That's just crazy. That's like an instinct that I think we all have to a great.
Because you build that hour, right? Like, and I think great artists don't think like that. Like, what is an hour? It's, you know, the older I'm getting, I'm realizing most of my friends are funny for hours and hours.
Yes.
And they don't consider that an hour. They're just husbands. And my father's hilarious. And inappropriate and racist and sexist and all those things. But he's not building an hour. He's just being himself.
Yes.
I remember once I had a corporate gig for Facebook. And Facebook has a very big back office in a town called Hyderabad in India. And because it's Facebook and they have lots of money, they did not... It was the monsoon, so it rains a lot in India. They didn't want to wait for a commercial flight. So they flew us in their private plane. So I thought that was a big thing. They're flying you in a private plane. I told my dad. And he said, yeah... I said, Dad, Facebook flew me in a private plane. And he had one comment. Those things are dangerous. Didn't ask me how the gig went. I said, Dad, imagine, I've arrived. Those things are very dangerous. Never do it again.
So do you think you need to, and I'm struggling for the word, when you said it's not disrespect, that's right, it's not disrespect. It's like a healthy, I don't know what the word is. I can't remember. It's on the tip of my tongue. Like a word for a healthy, a positive disrespect.
Yeah.
You know, you're uninhibited.
That's the word.
Yes.
Fearless. Yeah.
Fearlessness on stage. So maybe do you think that for you personally, part of the next phase of the journey is to cultivate that lack of inhibition? To kind of take the process out of it and the feeling that one is supposed to do well and one is supposed to give one's best, where actually, I'm not suggesting you wear a leather jacket and start smoking on stage, although whenever I see a comic doing that, I always think that's someone who's trying very hard to overcome the same challenge that we're talking about, you know.
I mean, we all use different ways. He's using a shtick. He's using sort of a thing. And
like, look how little I care is also a way of caring, isn't it?
He's terrified.
Yeah.
If you sat with him, he's petrified, that person. Yes. I think the answer to that is yes. I don't know how to break the inhibition. But I've had a lot of practice. The Comedy Store started bringing some of us over in 2010 and 11 to give us 5-7 minute sets. And this, I'm just sharing with you now that I'm doing an hour in London. The first 2 years I came over, nobody knew. I came quietly, basement in Leicester Square, British audience, because we'd never played in front of mainstream British audiences before. Disaster. Okay. Disaster because of how hyped I was, how much pressure I gave myself, rather than thinking this would just be an audience in a cosmopolitan city. It could be Mumbai. They're English speaking. Don't worry about it. No. I just pressurized myself into...
I'm performing in London.
British people, so well dressed. Look at them. They look like straight out of Downton Abbey. You know, like... Ugh. Disaster. Disaster. Tried to write new material. Disaster. Over the years, after a few failures, I calmed down a little bit, started going back to the old material, even though they were very India-specific. And people were laughing. They're knowledgeable. They know. And so, again, I'm on a similar journey because this is a whole hour. I'm on a similar trajectory to build that rapport for an hour with an audience. This is a lesson also. 50 shows at a stretch, 30 shows at a stretch. The discipline, you know. Mm. That sometimes I'll be uninhibited and be like, it's fine, I'm in London. Then day four, I think it's the colonial upbringing. Day four, I'll be like, you're in London. Yeah. You know, like...
Some internal programming to respect the situation.
Oh, you messed up that night. Whatever. And I could be... I think audiences in this town are really, really sharp. Audiences in Bombay are very sharp as well. But they'll give you a pass. If they know you, they'll give you a bit of a pass. So, like, if you incorrectly deliver a bit of a joke, they'll still give you a big laugh if your last joke was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one is fine. These guys, your audiences judge you on what you're telling them. So I had a practice gig in Covent Garden at a comedy club. Saturday night, there were stag doos, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, gosh, I'm going to go out there and talk about Indian history and empire. No problem. Laughing. Stag do, drunken people, laughing. I had a story in the middle about an Indian uncle who's a bit racist and the rubbish he says. And I delivered it badly because I went home and I realized I forgot to give them the context of the whole setup.
Sure.
So middle of the gig, 15 minutes, going great, 5 minutes. So you can't, like, and then I went off and some people were like, oh, it's the crowd, you know, they're drunk. It's not them. It was me. It wasn't them. It's because there were far more complicated jokes about British history that they were laughing at. So I've always been of the belief that it's never the audience. Like if we sat back and looked at the set, either in one's nervousness or in one's hurry, you haven't said something or you forgot something. Or like I love your home renovation shows. Like I'm just beginning to see how you guys are obsessed with buying houses. We're obsessed with buying houses, but you guys are taking it to the next level.
Okay.
And there's something I'm searching for there that's funny, like some sort of a scene that I was trying to write for the last couple of days. And I haven't found it, you know. So I'll get that response. Like, I'll start saying, I love your home renovation shows.
Yes.
They laugh at that. And they're like, okay, now make an observation.
They want you to, what is it about them? Come on, we're with you. We're with you. What is it?
Now, in India, I could have said home renovation shows and said a thing that was a little unprepared and a little rubbish. And because they laughed at the first bit, I'd be carried through.
Yes, okay.
Here, they're like... You've given us the thing, see it through.
Okay.
We're listening to every word.
Yes.
We've paid money. We're listening to everyone. So it's proper hard work.
And do you think that will make you a better comic? Do you think that's a sort of, that's a good creative environment? Are there any downsides to that sort of audience experience?
You know, I mean, look, I come from my father was in ships, and I come from a sort of working class Indian family because he used to work physically on ships. And I grew up being told there's nothing wrong in hard work. So, you know, yes, it'll make you a better comic, but it'll also make you alert on stage every second. And that can't be a bad thing. So you'll be by default working harder because you're like, they're listening for everything. I can't phone this joke in, you know, like, so every night you have to be on your toes.
And at the same time, we were discussing as well, that thing about authenticity, that then you've got to make the decision whether, what is your biggest motivator on stage? Is it a laugh at any cost, or is it an authentic laugh?
Correct.
And if there's no laugh, well, at least you were authentic. Like, correct, that's a decision we've all got to make as well.
Correct. Big point. When I was bombing a lot in those early years in London, two or three times I came down, and, you know, comedy store were really encouraging. They were like, 'cause I was probably the first one who started with them. Rest were all British comics. They were flying down, you know. All these guys were big in the club circuit. Ben Norris, Ian Stone, Alistair Barry, all these guys came down. Rob Deering, he was a big success. He has sung a song about biryani, which became a bit hit. Saltzman, of course. And then when all this was happening, they were very supportive. But Don Ward told me, be comfortable with silences. Because I realized three things when I started gigging here, which was, I have an accent. Mm-hmm. It may not be a pronounced one, but I have to address it, right? Because it sounds like I'm from here, but I'm not. Don't rush through the joke because you're nervous. Don't shout because people are listening. Those are the three things we do a lot in India when nobody's laughing. We get nervous, we start shouting. So just learning, one of the main things he said was, be comfortable with silences. Be okay with silences. People are listening. That's taken me a long time to
realize. It's such jujitsu, isn't it? I always think of that when I think of gigging at the Comedy Store. Something changed for my gigs there when I noticed how long it was before the people who are really good, the best acts there, how long it was before they spoke. They'd walk on stage and you could just sit at the Comedy Store and time how long it is before an act speaks a word into the microphone.
Wow.
And I think everyone wants to bring their A game to that club. It's known as having the highest quality control of, you know, any club in the country. And it's a fantastic room to play, as you know. But it's not even the speed. It's just the, when people walk on slowly and look at everyone and say, good evening, people go, oh, here we are, is this guy? Yeah, that took me so long. And as soon as I noticed it, it makes me laugh now because I'm like, oh, it's Sean Collins. It's going to be 15 seconds before he opens his mouth.
It's fabulous, right? And then you know that it's a journey. It's a journey. You're there with the guy for the evening. That comfort, I'm still learning. I'll probably not get to it till the end of my comedy career, which, you know, it's probably
tomorrow. Yeah. So talk to me then about your comedy as distinct from the next five acts on the bill that we might see in Mumbai. What marks you out from your peers?
You know, I'm one of the main things that every other. Well, I'll tell you. I had my birthday recently, and one of the comedians sent me a birthday message. Atul Khatri, he's a big comedian, but he talks a lot about family and being a 40-year-old man and kids and taking his children to Justin Bieber concerts. And he's Sindhi, which is he's an Indian community that are known for not spending money very much.
Okay.
So he talks about how he saves money when he travels abroad as a Sindhi, and he's multiplying everything in rupees and stuff.
Okay,
that's the kind of comedian he is, right? And he sent me a birthday message saying, and he sends a birthday message to every comedian, and he says, happy birthday, so-and-so. What can you give this person who already has dash? And the dash is usually their obsession.
Yeah. Okay, that's lovely.
So, and I think with Veer, he said, what can you give a person who's already like a comedy legend, who's obsessed with sex?
Like,
with me, he said, what can you give this person who's 42, balding, and has the British Empire? So I think the British influence on us has been a huge, at least also the part of India I come from, was the capital of British India for 250 years. Every second
Calcutta.
Every statue around me is like King George or Queen Victoria in the middle of a random Indian city. So, and the language, and because I went to a British school, and because, you know, it was a mix of, like, being taught to speak properly, but then half the country doesn't understand what you're saying, then becoming a retail entertainer in that country where English is on the decline. You know,
retail entertainer.
You know, I see myself as like, I don't know, maybe I'm being hard on myself, but I see comedy as like retail entertainment.
Is that a phrase that anyone else uses, or is that a youism? Is that a palism?
I use it, yeah.
That's a very funny name for a show. retail entertainment.
Well, you know, going back to my father, because the comedy store was inside a mall in Mumbai called Palladium. It still is, okay. Right? That's where it was and is. And a friend of his saw a show and went to my dad and said, you know, your son, he's become quite a comedian now. And my dad's like, yeah, he works in a mall now. And he saw it as retail entertainment because the next shop is Zara, you know?
Yes, like, yeah, of course,
he's like,
yeah.
My son could be working at Zara, helping people clothes, but he's in this mall.
But there's also, that's a very you phrase as well, because it also seems to have a note of humility and kind of resignation that the glamour is not so glamorous. They feel like quite true notes for you.
Yeah, and I feel very comfortable, you know, in this culture with that value system, mm-hmm. because America is a very sort of, let's celebrate. This is your moment. This is a big moment. There's a lot of pressure on celebrating yourself. And India is also like that. Like, mm-hmm. you've achieved something and there are lists. You know, you are a top 5 comedian. You know, there's constantly like people above people. Here, there's a celebration of failure.
Yes, yeah.
You know, absolutely. I love that I'm learning that there's a certain kind of, it's okay to say, if someone says it was great, it's okay to say, oh, shit.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to make friends with a British person, tell them a story in which you fuck up. Yeah. That's that 100%. I wish someone had told me that at school. That is like, you could be everyone's friend.
That is, I've always loved that value system. I just never found a culture that appreciates that, you know, like, I'll finish a gig and it'll be great. And someone will be like, that was very, very good. And I was like, oh. And they're like, why are you being like this? Like, they would get offended.
Yes.
That I was not. Whereas I mean nothing by it. I just like misery. You know, I enjoy, you know, misery is a strong word, but I enjoy failure. I think that failure is romantic and should be applauded, you know.
Yes.
And so, yeah, a lot of my comedy is about that. And from that perspective, I feel at home here, you know. But every other thing is, like I said, the jokes have to be good. Like, mm-hmm. like every other way, this culture is just like any other culture. It's just like, because it's so self-effacing. So that's a comedy style that I do a lot, you know, which is, Alive at 40 is really about like an essay of failures as a 40-year-old man.
Yes.
You know, and most of them true. Like, I don't even mean them as jokes. Like, just,
you're one about them, your mum tweeting as if she knows the people.
Yeah.
Like someone, like a star tweeting, I'm going to be at so-and-so, and your mum tweeting back, I can't make it. Yeah. I mean, God, I really laughed at that.
True story. She said that. Yeah. I mean, a lot of this is just from life in India they put in the show, you know. But you've got a range of young comedians, and there's, like, I think India has a version of, if you name XYZ, like if Zakir Khan is our Peter Kay, you know, somebody is our Doug Stanhope.
Sure.
You know,
okay.
Somebody is our Louis C.K. You know, like, it's like that. Because of my style and my age, I think there's a lot of like talk, like the press keeps saying, because I'm obsessed with empire and history. There's a lot of these, like, Dylan Morani, Azadi sort of comparisons that keep happening inaccurately because they're legends and I'm just a random middle-aged person working in a mall.
Yeah.
But the press kindly do these things. But there's a version of someone, like, there are young comics who are angry. You know, they haven't yet discovered a voice, but they're fabulous in their anger about politics or movies, or but you know that they're channeling some angry comedian they've seen in the West.
Yes.
Among the young, I love Karunesh Talwar. He's a great kid. Sapan Varma, great kid. And these guys, Sapan much more pleasant, but you know these guys have studied a lot of American comics. They've seen Dimitri Martin or Omid Jalili. Or, you know, like they've mm-hmm. done, everyone in India is doing their homework. But slowly, original voices are emerging. I think Zakir Khan, who's our Peter Kay, is perhaps the most original voice. Because he doesn't care what the laugh is. He'll tell you a half an hour story about how uncomfortable it is to live in a joint family in India where brothers and cousins, everybody lives together, and like a sex scene comes on mm-hmm. on television mm-hmm. and you have one shared television that everybody watches, and the mum gets uncomfortable, says, I'm going to go make snacks, and like he'll play out the entire discomfort, and he'll like have the father say a line, he'll have the brother walk out of the room, and he'll have him come back, and he'll just like milk it for the, and you know the entire middle class 10,000 people are just feeling that discomfort with him.
Yes.
At that comfort of storytelling that's just emerging now in India, you know, that I'm seeing that, and of course great female voices, you know, those are talking about issues that women feel. And you know, in any culture like in India, say Aditi Mittal and I will go in for the same gig, or we'll both go into a party, and her experience of that event will be completely different from a middle-aged man's experience of the event. There used to be a comedy venue in Pune called High Spirits, which all of us have played. And last year, there were some complaints that, you know, it was a very sexist place, and there was some harassment, etc. And then all these women comedians and other comedians started telling stories. And I read those and I was like, gosh, I was there that night, exactly that time. My experience as a middle-aged man, completely different. Mm-hmm. I was like, they told me, would you like a snack? And you went on. And this other person was like, this happened to me, this happened to me, this is how the promoter spoke to me. And you realize there are parallel Indias. And obviously these women comics are now discovering some of the stuff they can talk about and some of the horrendous things men say to them. And Radhika and Aditi, both of whom, Aditi has come to Soho and done Edinburgh and now gone to Melbourne. I think these are voices that women around the world are hearing and saying, this is no different than New York or Texas. So, whereas the things I'm talking about, which is specifically Britain and India's relationship, at least with Empire, is specific, is very specific and limiting.
Do you have, like, what's your next show? Are you cooking up the next hour?
You know,
given that we've discovered your fascination with Empire, is this the conclusion of the of that hour, or will you tour that hour for a few years while you write the next one? And what will be the theme of that?
There's something I'm beginning to discover, particularly doing a whole hour, is discovering bits within the hour that's going off in a different tangent. I talk about how my wife, when she, at dinner, because I've been married 12 years, calls, my dog's name is Caesar, she calls me and Caesar the same way to dinner. Right? And then I get upset at that, and then I say, if that's how you feel about me, why don't you get Caesar to pay the home loan, to pay him, get him to pay off the mortgage? And sure. Then Caesar says, yeah, the rates are quite good now. And then from there, I found a bit about your housing market, you know, the thing we talked about earlier. I don't know where that'll go, but there's something there that just comes out of an offshoot that I'm discovering over the last 2-3 days. If it becomes something, that'll be a little bit. And then if I find 10, 12 things like this, it's like, how do you weave it together into a set? Because it's also now is sitting into a conversation of a talking dog. You know, from there you're going to a chat about Britain's real estate. Like, but I'm finding things that I didn't know were there, you know. And I think I've never figured out stand-up comedy, you know. I've never figured out, meaning with a script, beginning, middle and end, you take characters down a journey, you write the end, you're done. Right? You go with actors, you revise it, you shoot it, you're done. This never ends. This never ends. You do an hour, you'll find 3 more minutes in it, and then like, what do? I throw it away? You don't throw it away. So this is like, you're ruined for life. It's like a drug. Because if you just go and repeat the exact hour, then it's memorization. Then it's back to my Indian high school. Sure. Then it's the worst aspects of it because you memorized, you didn't have fun. The joy is the finding. And you find, and then you're like, what do I do with it? And maybe you know, Stuart, because you've seen the best. You've toured with the best. You're on the other end of the spectrum. You know, maybe.
Well, I think, I mean, that's very kind of you to say, but I think that I often draw a certain amount of comfort from the fact that that experience of the joy is in the finding. The joy, I completely agree with that. The joy is in the finding. As soon as a bit absolutely works every time, I lose interest in it.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it again because that bit works. I want to discover, and you're probably to my detriment as a comic.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in finding. So what I draw comfort from is the idea that everyone draws comfort from the finding, and Russell Peters at Wembley Arena is probably the best bit of that gig for him is the tiny new bit that he just tucked in because he thought of it in the limo earlier that day. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's
so that
the
is the same pleasure. It's the same pleasure, whether, you know, if it's you or me in Soho to 100 people or something, as if we're playing Wembley.
And that's all right to do, right? That's the finding that... That I'm not somehow...
No, no, when you say that's all right to do right, I felt like you were asking for my permission.
I am.
No, well, you can't. I can't give it to you.
Correct.
Only you can give it to you. This is the next Zen state. Yeah. This is how you become wizard level. You can only ask yourself for permission.
That's the thing about sort of my education system, right? It's just that you have to seek permission to be creative. It's almost like I'm being allowed to play, and you almost have to ask a seasoned comedian, am I allowed to play, you know?
Yes.
Because I'm discovering that in this culture, because people are okay because they're so creative from a very young age. They're playing in their heads all the time, right? So I'm discovering that comfort, that it's okay to do that. And all of us have this problem. If you've got 10 Indian comedians in a room, and you're like, you know, you grew up in a culture where you save money and you study hard, you know, and which is why we have so many doctors and engineers and accountants and IT people, because it's a thing. You've memorized stuff and you know how to do this one thing well. Here we're in a creative profession, right? But we're still Indian in the way we think. So when you've got that hour, you think, this is my hour. I'm going to repeat it and make a living and buy a house, and it's an hour. And if you got 10 of us in a room, I wish 10 British comedians would slap us. just slap us to make us better comedians. It's just to unshackle us and say, yes, you did not have a creative education, but we're telling you it's okay to go out there and
the Comedians Comedian podcast officially now grants you and every other comedian listening to this the permission to try things, to experiment, to be your own masters.
thank you. I think it's time to start with that.
So I was going to ask about the elements of the creative process that you find the hardest or the most unforgiving. Obviously, one of your preoccupations is this idea of giving yourself permission to think outside of the box, to let go of the sort of the desire to have a thing that works and stick to the thing. What other things do you find particularly challenging? Or what a good way of asking this question maybe is, what sorts of things do you see other comics do that you think, I wish I could do that, I aspire to that element of comedy?
Not care about the laugh. You know, like I've seen like masters of comedy, and I bet if I came to see one of your gigs, all of you guys that do it a lot and gig a lot are more interested in the story. Like, I think they embed themselves in the story. And I don't know where the concentration comes from. Maybe it comes from yoga or wherever. I don't know. Or just spending the day drinking. I don't know where it comes from. Or being distracted, because all of those help. But not being lured by the laugh, but by the story. Because if you ignore the laugh, the mechanics go away. And then you think, oh, this is just two people having a conversation. Or I'm having a conversation myself. And I've just discovered a new bit. Now, the trick is... Sometimes when the lights are on at Soho in your eyes and you're trying out a new bit and no one's laughing, you think to yourself, oh, now I'm just... Like, now I've lost them. Because I didn't care for the laugh. Great. Now they're not laughing. But now I'm in an alien conversation with myself. I'm just enjoying myself. I can't see them. It's just a patch of dark. They're not saying anything. They're not laughing. I have these big... yellow lights in my face. At least at the Comedy Store, you can see some people because the lights are red. And you're like, what am I doing now? I've lost them. I'm just in a moment with myself. And maybe that's okay. You know, like maybe... So just discovering the line between where to just be hungry for the laugh as a shallow person, which I am often, and just remembering that it's the stories what they're laughing at. What that also helps to do is you're not tied to a word or a punchline if the context of the story is larger. I'll give you an example. I have a section that wasn't working at all in the build-up to Soho about how uncomfortable we are in India talking about sex, but we have a billion people. So when cultures that are okay talking about sex, like yours, come and see this, they're like, there's a lot of sex going on, man. They're shagging, which is the word you guys have here. Shagging. And we said, no, You say, and you're like, where are all these children coming from? God, namaste. You know, we say, and I got so focused on the mechanics of what the British person was saying to me and how I was hiding the sex and how I would play that out and the individual lines, I forgot that's not what's important. What's important is you're hiding the fact that you have a billion people. Every night, have a different conversation.
Yes. Yes, trust that that idea is funny enough that it doesn't matter how you say
what
it.
What words, exactly. And yeah. I was, every night I got stuck in my head on how to build to namaste, because one night in Bethnal Green, namaste got the laugh.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, I must somehow get there. Whereas that's not the joke. The joke is the British person could say anything. He could just look absurd at people behind having sex. You've set that image in people's heads. Trust the people. It took me a long time. Still takes me a long time. Will take me tonight. It'll be hard, you know? Like, again, confidence, education. I think it's a lot of those things. But I always jump the gun and think, oh, I found the bit. The N word is funny. No. That's never the thing.
Thank you. That's a really good exploration of that idea. Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
I mean, I don't even know if it's accurate. I just stumbled on a bit that had an extended bit. And now it's working because I just stopped ignoring the lines. And I don't know if there's any insight here, but it's just, you were asking what's difficult. I found that very difficult. That,
yes.
That cling on to that word and get to that word somehow and make it an act and people are laughing, get to namaste. No, that's not the... And again, it's about how we think about storytelling, because I grew up with so much rote memorization, memorize, that... Even Shakespeare plays, when we would study in school, our teachers would say, memorize, rather than just understand what was in the play. So to break that and to think, story is bigger. Doesn't matter how you act it out. Maybe you won't get to namaste. Maybe you'll say something else to the British person. Doesn't matter. That confidence takes me a while. I'm inherently a terrified person. I'm in a new culture. So yeah, that takes me a while.
Are you happy?
As a comedian? My wife said... You're usually miserable on your show days, and I don't disagree with that. She said you do this for now 8 years. Shouldn't you enjoy it? Given it's taken up so much of your life, it's taken up so much of our life, so much time when you could have been with friends, etc. You should. I don't know what it is. This is why I like your country so much, because I've come across famous comedians in the country who feel the same. I feel that sort of connect, you know, that you guys also derive no joy from this. Like, you Stuart will have a great gig and people will come and hug you, and in your head will be that bit at 20 minutes didn't work, and then I went into that bit, didn't work. That whole sort of, oh, I've done it for a while, let's celebrate, let's make you a god. Like, I come from a culture where sudden success will also lead to like sudden celebration. Our Bollywood stars are like gods, right? Mm. I mean, I'm not saying they work any less hard than British actors, but the fact that it's just work. It's work and you're trying to get mechanics right and it's okay to be miserable. That's new for us.
Mm.
Which is why, like, you know, I mean, Veer is a huge celebrity in India. Huge celebrity. And I think that if he had an off night, they would forgive him. And they would still, like, think he was a genius, etc. But here... the comedian would not celebrate that night. He would go home and he'd be like, oh, I'm the worst. I'm just... It would eat him away, you know, like... And I love that. So I don't know. I think it was... I think it's probably inappropriate now to quote Woody Allen, given the world we live in now. But fair enough. I don't know anything about a private human being and an artist. But as an artist, he had quoted... that every day you write something, and if it's a little less horrible, you go to bed a little bit happier. So I think that's how I look at the writing. If it's a little less horrible, I think the only thing I can now tell is when I'm being horrible on stage, and to stop and acknowledge that and move on. At least that realization I now have. But happy is a tricky one. Happy is a tough one. I'm also 42, right? So... I played Switzerland with Ben Norris, and Ben, I think at one point turned and said, you know, at 40, he's 45, and he said, you know, at some point you should think about retiring or something. Like, at some point, I've started talking about retirement, you know, like, what's the next step? And so you think to yourself, but at the same time, this is a profession where people go on into their 70s and, you know, it's... So, I don't know. I'm not... I mean, happy is a strong word. I don't know if I'm happy, but I don't know what's next. I think what keeps me going is just the discovery of the new bits in every show. And I've never been a smart business guy. And I know, as an Indian person, I should be. But a lot of things have just fallen into place. But I've never planned it. I don't have a comedy company. I'm fortunate to have agents here and in Bombay. But everything just happened accidentally. And so I don't have a plan for the next hour or... there's talk of Edinburgh this year. So now the question is just pacing yourself. Like 5 nights, if you can do it, can you do it for 30 nights? And so I'm thinking in small blocks. And also, can I find 2 more minutes here? So I don't know. I may be penniless by August. I have no idea. Because London's expensive. I've just found that if I keep the thought process small, and also because I'm not that intelligent, it's easy for me to have limited thought process. It's easier. It's easier, you know? Sorry, I'm just rambling. Sorry.
No, it was lovely. It was I was just waiting because you kept being fascinating, so I kept being quiet to let you keep being fascinating. And then just at that last pause, I was going to say... thanks, man. And officially finish it. And then just before I could, you went, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm rambling. Which was the perfect end.
So that was Anuvab. Loads more to hear from him on the private podcast, which you too can join at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And if you can't remember that, thanks to a very canny listener called Laura Serbin, you can also get a redirect to that site by going to cashforgoldsmith.com. But I do feel a bit, although it makes me laugh, I feel it's a bit grabby. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit on the nose. Give me your money. So that's where you can find out more from Anuvab and everyone recently. Sophie Willen, she's got some extra stuff on there, as well as all those other projects that I mentioned before. Thanks for listening. I'm going to have a bit of a post-amble at you shortly. But for now, do remember to check out Anuvab at this year's Edinburgh Festival if you're going. And join the Facebook group. You can get involved with all sorts of back and forth projects, all sorts of things to get stuck into there with the... God, what are we on now? 6,000? Almost 6,000? More than... I think it's 6.2... I mean, it's an awful lot of people, a lot of fans of this show, and that's completely free, of course. It's just a Facebook group, but it is private. So when you join up, just tell me, answer a couple of fun questions on there, and that helps me sort out the scammers from the genuine fans. You can join the Facebook group, and we can have a bit more of a conversation about some of the stuff that is coming your way in the near future. Oh, what a week. I've been busy. I've been really busy. I'll post-amble at you in just a second. But for now, that concludes the podcast. So listen, this post-amble, I've got a couple of emails to read out. They're mostly going to take up the time for this because I've just had some beautiful emails recently. This is from a listener called James. I came to see you in North... Look, forgive me because this is very complimentary towards me, but there's something else in it that I want to talk about. I have cut some of the more gushing stuff. He says, I came to see you in Northampton last week. I was surprised by your physical performance. Precision, I'd call it. I did not expect it to add so much to the fantastic material, but it did, man, it did. I could see the energy you were focusing in different places, sweeping moves, puckish little head flicks. The hair is the right hair. Look, we're going to move past puckish little head flicks. Now, that's maybe a new T-shirt. But music to my ears. The hair is the right hair. Thank you, James. I am definitely less funny after a haircut. I've always thought because I look too slick. He says, so look, you don't pack everything you are into your podcast. You've got so much more going on. This is because in the post-amble of last week's show, I talked about, I opened up to some feelings of jealousy about other people's podcasts. And I wondered if that was a good idea at the time, but a lot of people have said some very positive things. He says, I'm constantly driven by nemeses. Every fucking job I've had. Now, that's either a spectacular 25-year run of bad luck, or I sort of need that nemesis figure. He says, it's bullshit. I need to carry on being the most me I can be and realising myself to my fullest and dreaming up new fullests to realise the end. He says, no need to reply to this. I just wanted to let you know I really loved Like I Mean It. The performance, the controlled whips of energy, the strong, quiet sections, and the new show's got a lot of great stuff going, clearly. The Shackleton line, timeline bit, mwah. Well, I agree. I also think that's mwah.
I mean, that's a whole other thing. It's fast becoming the best bit of the new show, the Shackleton bit, which if you've seen it, you'll go, yeah, it really is. So here's the question. Do I put the best bit at the beginning or the end? Do I put it at the start to sort of set the tone? Or do I end it on that bit to finish on a super memorable bit? Answers on a postcard, please. He goes on. This is the finish of his thing. He says, the pod and your delicate, responsive and occasionally bold interviewing skills, not to mention your instinct for encouraging and enthusing with fellow comics, show there's more than enough positivity and support in you for everyone who needs it. It doesn't diminish us. It nourishes us. And if you and I need that bit of Nemesis grit to make the pearl, well, that's how it is. James, thank you. I really appreciate that. Not just because of the very pleasant things you've said about the act, and it's always very, very satisfying to... I've got some quite nice fan mail as a result of the touring shows I've been doing, and I really appreciate all of that. But also, you're right. Maybe we do need the grit of a Nemesis to get to the pearl. Maybe that is just... Come on, we can't all just be infinitely happy and creative at the same time. Maybe you do need to occasionally get really wound up and feel jealous of things. As long as it's done in a sort of safeguarded, calm manner, maybe it's absolutely fine. Thank you, James. I also want to briefly thank Darren Govey, who sent me a kids track by a comedy band, which was, what is it called? I think it's called Better Than You. And it's a very funny, very funny song. I'll link to that on Twitter. I was going to tell you something else. I'm in Newcastle tonight, as I mentioned, and something funny happened last time I was here, whereby I lost my car in a car park, and I didn't even know which car park it was, and my phone had died, and it was a big, long... I mean, you know, the story doesn't go anywhere. It's just an example of me being a dick that I thought you might enjoy. And then, moments ago, I got this email from a lady called Tori Burton. I haven't edited this down, so I'm just going to whiz through it. Bear with me. She says, Stu, I said I wouldn't be in touch again until I'd done two things, performed and sent you some clams. Well, this is my celebration for the one I've been dreaming of writing. She said earlier in the email that she's from Prague. I don't know if she's from Prague or is just in Prague. But she says, firstly, I'm sending £2 a month. I want to make. I'm going to make some bonus donation when I get paid. However, I've listened to everything like I'm in the conversation, related so hard to people and their methods that I thought I must have this. I've cried with the podcast, shouted at it, disagreed with it, clapped my hands and spat out tea. Last night, I was asked to do one 20-minute set. I haven't done that before, or any stand-up at all. Jesus, Tori, jumping at the deep end. She said, I just listened to the Angela Barnes episode, and she says I never moved on to 10 minutes until I'd totally got five down, and I thought, fuck. But then a few minutes later, she said, but I wish I could take more risks. Well, I didn't make the gig I told you about in my last email months ago, and I felt like a bellend since. Do they have the word bellend in Prague, or is that from the podcast? We had a tough year here, and life felt like it took the funny out of me for a while, but I know full well, for every time this happens, content is breeding in the background. It is. I never turned off the writing in my mind. Everything in life is funny eventually. I think we can all see where this is going. Tori continues. So for my first time, I had a nice room of 20 or 25 people, a mic, lights, etc., all like in my imagination. Everyone howled. I killed it, I believe. So they said, 2 hours later, they asked me to do it again, about 40 people by then. So I just did it, and I got to test out loads of different methods. I was right about myself. I can write, I can improvise. It was good. I have been born. She goes on to say about she's going to keep working, open miking, try and get to the fringe. I'm 36 nearly, I better get the fuck on with it. True story. Whooping and cheering because I made a funny. I am born. Oh, there's some more stuff there, but I just wanted to finish off this postamble today, particularly in the spirit of the energy that we talked about in the exploding scene in India and how it's just full of all this kind of vitality and energy. What a wonderful sentiment. Thank you, Tori Burton. You are born. This is beginning to sound a bit Scientologist. So I'm not going to go into that anymore. She says, everything feels right about this. I'm very excited. I could bang on forever. And you were the first person I wanted to inform from all the serious hours in my ears. Thanks, 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 Tori Burton. Well, Tori, what can I say? But hey, you're welcome. That just puts such a spring in my step. All day. I will add you to the list of people who've been given a nudge of some sort by this podcast to get into it. And thank you for telling me. More power at your elbow. And congratulations to anyone out there who has taken a risk of this sort and thought, I can do it, and done it, and then got born. Get yourself born, people. That's all for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.